Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're live from 2 to 3. Excuse me, that's this afternoon. That is true, but that's not right now. We're live right now from 9:30 to 10 in the morning. Some of you know that I do this program twice a day, once in the morning and once in the afternoons. And so from time to time, I forget which time of the day it is. Right now it's 9:30 in the morning. And from 9:30 to 10, we have a half hour together live in which you can call in if you would like to with questions you might have about the Bible or about Christianity, or to balance comment if you think that something that's been said on the show by the host needs balancing or correcting. Feel free to do that. You will be welcome here if you call even with a disagreement. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. I mentioned I do the program twice a day, but not on the same stations. The morning program, which you're listening to, is carried by some stations, and the afternoon program by other stations. But if you're interested in both programs, you can hear them both streamed from my website, which is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. You can hear either of the programs, either or both, live or later, because they are archived also. So that's at thenarrowpath.com. Again, if you want to reach me here, the number is 1-800-227-5278. And we're going to talk first to Harry from Fallbrook, California. Harry, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes. One of the blessings on the Sermon on the Mount is blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I'd like you to explain that.
Okay, poor in spirit. You know, perhaps one of the things that makes this confusing is that one can sort of in their own mind try to connect a parallel between being physically poor and spiritually poor. And one could understand Jesus saying, well, if you're physically poor but rich in spirit, that'd be a good thing. But instead he says, if you're poor in spirit, that's a good thing. And so that's a bit unexpected. However, the term poor in spirit, as has been sometimes pointed out by commentators, the word poor means beggars, people who are beggars, spiritually speaking. People who know that they have nothing to offer and they must depend upon the grace and generosity of someone else for their spiritual well-being. Just like a beggar is that way physically. A person who's a physical beggar knows that he cannot make any contribution to his own upkeep. He has to receive the gracious generosity of other people. And that's the spiritual attitude that one must have. And I think that Jesus is using it to contrast what was so common among the religious people of his own day, the Pharisees, who saw themselves as having a great deal that they had to offer, a lot to offer God by their own righteous conduct and so forth. They saw themselves as earning or producing or even contributing something to their own spirituality rather than seeing themselves as needy beggars upon God's mercy. Remember, Jesus told the story about two men who came to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, and the other was a sinful tax collector. And the Pharisee congratulated himself and said, God, I thank you. I'm not like other men. I'm not like this tax collector here. I don't commit great sins, and I pay my tithes, and I fast twice a week. And he was basically congratulating himself for being so spiritual and so religious. But then the tax collector, Jesus said he was so ashamed he couldn't even lift his face to heaven. He just beat his breast and said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus said this second man went home justified in the sight of God, not the other one. And what Jesus is saying is the man who thought that he had so much to offer God, really, he did. He was just deceived. The man who knew he had nothing to offer to God but just begged for mercy was like a beggar. He was poor in spirit. He didn't claim any spiritual superiority or spiritual wealth that he could bring to the table, but rather he was just dependent on the mercy of God. I think that's what poor in spirit means in that beatitude as well.
Can we stated in another way, that blessed are the simple in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Simple in spirit? Well, I think that conveys a different idea, but it might be a good one too. I mean, it may not be what this beatitude is saying, but I think that being simple rather than complex could be a good thing, depending on how it's meant.
When Jesus was with the crowds and the children ran up to him and wanted to sit on his lap, whatever, and they were rebuked by the apostles, didn't Jesus say that allow them to come here because of these is what the kingdom is all about? Mm-hmm. So if, and certainly a child could be simple in spirit, and do you think it refers, you know, if heaven is for children or children like people, would you not think that the word simple would be a good substitute for the word poor?
Well, not necessarily. I certainly would agree with you that the simplicity of childhood is a positive thing, but it's not the only thing. I mean, in different passages, just Jesus speaks about different character traits. I think that being childlike is certainly one character trait. Being like a beggar is another. Both are good, and both are discussed in different places. But
well,
we're
talking just about spirit here. There are other blessings bestowed upon people who are righteous to inherit both earth and heaven. But in this particular case, we're talking strictly on spirit. And the simpler you are on that, it seems the better.
Well, I'm not denying that. I'm just saying that the poor in spirit is one aspect of a person's spiritual state. Being generous in spirit would be another, or being simple in spirit, or childlike in spirit, or humble in spirit. There's lots of different ways to describe a right spirit. They're not all explained in the same passage necessarily, and I don't think that when Jesus said blessed are the poor in spirit, he's trying to explain every detail of a person's spiritual condition, but he's trying to focus on a particular aspect, which is very much different than the Pharisees' attitudes.
Exactly. When you said the difference between the Pharisee was boasting about all these things he was doing and this and that and whatever, and then the other person who couldn't measure up at all because he thought of himself as a sinner, where you come to the kingdom of heaven as a contrite individual and not boasting about all the stuff that you know or have done, again, it would seem to me that it's a very narrow focus on this particular blessing, but it seems that the simple in spirit seems to be better rather than the poor in spirit because of what I just mentioned. You go there.
Well, the problem is that the word that Jesus used doesn't mean simple, it means poor. Now, we could say Jesus should have said the simple in spirit, but then you have to take that up with him because he chose his own words. If he wants to say simple in spirit, he probably could say that. If he wants to say poor in spirit, he could say that. You asked my opinion as to whether simple in spirit would be a better way of rendering that first beatitude. My opinion is it's not a better way, but simple in spirit is a good thing. Okay, that's my opinion. If you certainly don't have to accept it.
Right. Maybe it just came down to the translation that way from Aramaic, and the best word that we chose for that word in Aramaic was poor, whereas
We didn't choose that word. That was chosen by Matthew when he translated what Jesus said into Greek. So, I mean, I guess you could say that Matthew did not understand as well as you do what that Aramaic word meant, but at least in Matthew's opinion, it meant poor. And I got a feeling, since Aramaic and Greek were both languages that Matthew spoke from childhood, probably he did know the right translation. I tend to accept Matthew's translation. I actually need to move along because I have my lines full. But I think I've answered your question. If you feel that poor in spirit should be substituted with simple in spirit, I'm not really sure on what basis grammatically you could go on that. If you're simply trying to say that being simple in spirit is a good thing, I agree. If you're saying that therefore Jesus should have said that in the first beatitude, I don't necessarily agree. I don't think he didn't have to say everything he wanted to say in one statement. Let's talk to Lisa from San Pedro, California next. Lisa, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a question. In Jeremiah 22:30, God pronounced a curse on Jeconiah, and he said that none of his descendants should prosper, and yet Joseph, I guess, was a descendant of Jeconiah.
That's right.
So it seems like he prospered because he was married to Mary, and they had Jesus. So I guess that confuses me, and I want to know your opinion.
Well, the curse in Jeremiah says that none of Jeconiah's seed will prosper sitting on the throne in Judah anymore. That is, none of Jeconiah's offspring will be king anymore. Jeconiah himself was descended from all the kings of Judah from David on, and there's no reason why he should have been the last, except that there was a curse on him and that the nation went into captivity. So, in other words, God was saying he's breaking off the hereditary monarchy in that line. He's not going to give it to anyone who's a descendant of Jeconiah anymore. Now, you're right that Joseph, in Matthew chapter 1, is said to be descended from Jeconiah. Joseph, the husband of Mary. And it specifically says in Matthew that Joseph was the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, the Christ. Now, Jesus, therefore, was not a seed of Joseph. He was not the seed of Jeconiah. Jesus came through Mary, but not through Joseph, because Joseph was not his father. Therefore, Joseph did not pass along that curse to Jesus. And therefore, Jesus can be the king of the Jews. Now, the Messiah did have to be physically descended from David, but there were various ways to be descended from David. You didn't have to go through Solomon and the kings. You could go through one of David's other offspring. And it would appear, from how I understand Luke 3, verses 23 to the end of that chapter, that we have a genealogy which I believe is the genealogy of Mary. And she is descended from David. And so Jesus, coming literally from Mary, is descended from David and therefore can be the Messiah. But he's not descended from Jeconiah, because he would be if he was Joseph's son. But he was not Joseph's son. He was only foster son. And for that reason, Jesus did not come into that curse. Now, Joseph did. And for that reason, Joseph himself could never have been king of the Jews, because he was the seed of Jeconiah.
Okay, that makes sense. It's always, you brought up another issue, which is always confusing to me. It seems like they always talk about the seed, and you would think that Jesus would have been born down the male line as opposed to through Mary's descending from David.
Yeah.
I understand what you understand, too, that it's through Mary, that being a descendant of David, that Jesus was born. But it seems like in the Old Testament, everything went through the men. So that's just a little bit, I don't know, you just wonder sometimes, I guess.
Yeah, the genealogies usually are traced through the men. But there's a lot of things in the way that God set up the inheritance of things in the Messianic line that defied conventional ways of looking at things. For example, the conventional thing was for the firstborn son to carry on the family name and have the birthright. But it was, in Abraham's case, God chose the second son, Isaac, not the firstborn. And then among Isaac's children, God chose the secondborn son, Jacob, not Esau. And among Jacob's descendants, it was not the firstborn, Reuben, who received birthright, but Judah, the fourthborn. So it's like, throughout this entire family where God was bringing the Messiah, God seemed to be defying the conventions of, you know, family inheritance and so forth. And this seems to be, maybe why he brought Jesus through the woman's side in this particular case. Although, of course, the woman involved was descended through the male lineage of David. You have to realize that Mary was a seed of David. It's just that you're right, Jesus was not the seed of a man, but as Genesis chapter 3 refers to him as the seed of the woman. Remember, in Genesis 3, God is speaking to Eve and says, through, you know, there I'll put enmity between you and the serpent, between your seed and his seed, and your seed shall bruise his head, and he shall bruise his heel. Now, it talks about Eve's seed, which is a strange word, because the word seed literally means sperm. In fact, in the Greek, the word seed is sperma, and we get our English word sperm from that. The seed is always associated with the man, but there's a strange break away from that custom in the case of Jesus being born the seed of the woman. Strange indeed it is, but many people think that Jesus came through the woman and without a human father rather than vice versa, because sinfulness or the sinful nature is passed down through the father and not through the mother. Now, I don't know that the Bible specifically teaches that, but that is the way many theologians have understood it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay, Lisa. Good hearing from you.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for your call. Bye now. All right, let's talk next to Jackie calling from Modesto, California. And we have a line open for you at 1-800-227-5278. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and if you'd like to be on the air with me, you can call 1-800-227-5278. Jackie, thanks for calling, and welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, I have a question regarding Judges 11:30, where Jethro make a vow to God.
Yes.
To offer sacrifice. What is your intake on that?
Well,
Jethro
made a
thing, but you know, my belief is that God does not like human sacrifice, so I don't think it was done. Maybe she was a virgin forever, but some people said she was sacrificed. I was like,
Yeah. Well, it's true. Here's what Jethro said when he was going to war against the Ammonites. In Judges 11:30, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed deliver my people, the people of Ammon, into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the people of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." Now, of course, the first thing that met him out of his house when he came back victorious was his own daughter, his only child, and this grieved him. And it later says, and he went out and he carried out his oath, and he did what he said he would do. Now, what did he say he would do? Many people feel that he was just saying, whatever it is, I'm going to sacrifice it to the Lord. But under the law of Moses, many things could not be sacrificed to the Lord. An unclean animal, for example. If a dog or a rat had run out of his house when he got home, he couldn't offer that to the Lord. That'd be an unclean animal. If a donkey came out or, you know, whatever, and people did keep their livestock inside the houses, so it could have been that some unclean creature could have come out, or a human, as it was in the case of his daughter. Certainly, one would think he could not have felt that he could offer just anything to the Lord, no matter what it was. And so some people interpret his statement, although it doesn't sound quite natural to do so, but some people interpret him as saying this, whatever comes out of the door of my house will be the Lord's, period. And then with this other addition, and it is implied, if it is a clean animal, I will offer it as a burnt offering. Now, the implication that if it is a clean animal is not stated and may not be implied, but some people think it is. So that what he's saying is, no matter what meets me coming out of the house will be dedicated to the Lord. That can be a human being. That can be any kind of animal. Any kind of animal can be dedicated to the Lord, which would mean that it would be taken to be a gift to the priests at the tabernacle. If it was a human being, that person would then become a servant of the Levites at the tabernacle. Remember,
like
Samuel
Jackson.
Was given to the Lord that
yes.
way.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. And so many people think that's what Jephthah did with his daughter rather than sacrificing her.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right. God bless you.
You do. Bye.
Bye now. Okay, we have another caller from Modesto, and that is Ron from Modesto. Thanks for calling, Ron. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, thank you for having me on the program. I have a question. I just got a call from a friend I've been reading Bible with and stuff. He's a new believer. He had a question. He didn't give me the address of the scripture. He said it was in Matthew. I know I've read it before. And it's concerning when the transformation with Jesus, Moses, and Elijah on the mountain.
That's Matthew 17. Yeah, Matthew 17.
Okay, so mm-hmm. Matthew 17. His question was, when Moses was sent, when Moses passed, he was, he went to Sheol, I guess that's what it is. He went to the grave, and supposedly he sinned against God. I'm not sure exactly what was going on with Elijah, but they were all three there. The disciples saw that, and then they saw just Jesus. And his question was, is how was it that a man that was still in had the sin nature was there with Jesus in the spirit with Jesus, before Christ's death on the cross, to where he was forgiven of those sins? Kind of follow what I'm saying, to where he was able to be with Jesus at that time before
you
Jesus
talk about
actually
Moses.
Went to the cross.
How yeah, could how could Moses be forgiven of his sins before Jesus died?
Yes, to where they can stand together when the transformation happened with Jesus, Moses, and Elijah.
Well, there's a couple of possible ways to look at that. One is to see that Old Testament saints, when they died, were in fact justified because they had faith in God. And we remember what it says about Abraham, who was an Old Testament saint. In Genesis 15:6, it says, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. And even David lived in the Old Testament. And in Psalm 32, when he's talking about how he had sinned with Bathsheba and then later had repented, he said, how happy, Psalm 32:1 says, how happy is the man whose sins are forgiven. How blessed is he against whom the Lord does not impute iniquity. So even in the Old Testament, the forgiveness of sins was known. Now, if we could say, well, if God could forgive in the Old Testament, then why did Jesus have to come and die? Well, I believe, this is what I believe, that God always intended for Jesus to come and die, to pay for the sins of the world, to pay for the sins of those who had died before he came and those who would live and die after he came. That is,
right.
To die for the sins of all time. Therefore, since God already had purposed to send Jesus, there's a sense in which he could forgive people on credit, you know, on Jesus' credit, and Jesus would come and pay the tab. So that
right,
even
right.
in the Old Testament, God, knowing that Jesus would come and die, could forgive men of faith and women of faith because of what Jesus was going to do. And so,
in a
sense, God forgiving them at that time could be putting it on Jesus' tab, and then when Jesus came, he paid it.
Okay.
That's one way of looking at it. See, another way of looking at it is this. When Jesus was coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration with the disciples, he said to them, don't tell this vision to anyone. And I don't think it's in Matthew's version, but the story is also found in Mark 9 and in Luke 9. And in one of those places, Jesus says, do not tell this vision to anyone. And so some have felt like this was a vision the disciples had rather than an actual appearance of those men.
Okay.
In a vision, a vision can be like a dream, only one has it when they're awake. You know, I mean, in a dream, you might dream that you meet a certain person who you really know in real life, but they're not really there. You're just, it's in your mind. You know, it's something being conveyed to your mind. And so also when people had dreams and visions that were inspired by God, it doesn't mean that the persons in them were necessarily literally there, but they were seeing something in a vision form, like a waking dream. And so some could say that Moses and Elijah were not personally there, but that they were seen in a vision there.
Now, how many disciples saw this take place? Would they have the same vision at the same time?
Yeah, there were three of them.
Okay, so would they have the same vision at the same time then?
Yes.
Interesting.
Which is unusual indeed, yes. I mean, it's not common for people, multiple people, to see the same vision simultaneously. But if God wished it to happen, it certainly could happen. You know, I've heard of cases in modern times where everybody in a small North African village had a dream the same night about Jesus, and they all woke up and became Christians. Now, it's interesting that God could give such a dream to everybody at the same time, the same dream. But he could do the same thing with a vision, I suppose, if he wished to, with these men.
That's true.
So there's some question. There's some question as to whether Moses and Elijah were personally there or whether the disciples were just shown a vision from God.
Right. Right. Okay, great. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Either of those answers might work.
All right. Thank you. God bless.
God bless you, Ron. Bye now. Okay, Sam from Los Angeles. We don't have very much time, I'm afraid, but welcome to the Narrow Path. We especially don't have time if you're not at the phone. Sam, are you there? Okay, we have to hang up. Just let me give some instructions to callers. When you call, you are listening on the radio to a delay, like 40 seconds delay of the program. That means if you call and we put you on hold and you get away from the phone and you listen on the radio and I call your name on the phone, I'm calling your name on the air, but you won't hear it on the radio for 40 seconds more. That means I'm going to have to call your name for 40 seconds or not, and I'm not going to do that. So if you call and you're waiting to be online, please stay on the phone so you'll know when I call you, because I don't really like to have to just hang up. I'd rather talk to you. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. This is a daily broadcast from 9:30 to 10 each weekday morning. We are a listener-supported ministry. We pay for the radio time, and if you'd like to help us out, you can find information about doing so at our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Now, if you don't want to help us out financially, that's okay. There's a lot of free resources at the website. Nothing for sale. Lots of valuable resources at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow so we can continue our discussion. God bless you.